Ethical Considerations in Disorders of Consciousness. That's the title of an interview with Dr. Joseph Finns, published in the October-December issue of the American Journal of Bioethics Neuroscience. Joining us now on the Bioethics Channel is Dr. Joseph Finns. He is the Chief of Medical Ethics at Weill Cornell Medical College. And we're also glad to have with us Dr. Art Kaplan, Director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Finns, one issue you discussed in this interview was that patients who are thought to be in a vegetative state are not as fixed or locked in as we once thought. Talk about that, if you would, please.
Well, I mean, some vegetative patients are. Locked in is a bad phrase because locked in refers to people who have intact cognitive function and have no motor output. So I don't want to use that word locked in. Metaphorically, there are patients who appear to be vegetative on the clinical exam, who when you put them in the scanner and you query them in certain ways, may demonstrate an awareness of self, others, or the environment, and we would call those people minimally conscious. But I want to be clear about one thing as we get started, is that the vegetative state is an intact dialogical, nosological category, and it's not to say that people can't be vegetative, and that is without an awareness of themselves or others. As Plum and Jeanette described it, it's wakeful unresponsiveness. And there are some people who are thought to be vegetative who are not, but there are also, you know, people who are vegetative, who are permanently vegetative. Now, the other point in your question is some people transition through the vegetative state and route to a higher level of recovery. But once you get into the permanent vegetative state, like Cruzan or Shiva or Quinlan, these people were permanently, irretrievably vegetative, and there was no hope for any recovery given the nature of their injury and its longevity.
Do very many people either out on the street or in the medical community recognize or understand that some people go through the vegetative state to get to that higher level that you talk about? Is there an area of confusion there?
Yeah, there's tremendous confusion, I think in part because of the way the history evolved, that we saw this as the initial people were described as persistent vegetative state, okay? And by today's categories, we'd say they were permanently vegetative, the Quinlans, the Cruzans, the Shivas. But the way the history evolved, we actually discovered the vegetative state before we described the minimally conscious state, which came into the literature in 2002, which is 30 years after Plum and Jeanette described the vegetative state in 1972. But it's interesting, if you look at the Multi-Society Task Force Report, which was written in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1994, people like Ron Cranford were involved with that, who was also involved in the Cruzan case in a big way. But they argued, and they rightly did, they said, you know, the persistent vegetative state is a diagnosis. The permanent vegetative state is a prognosis, because there were some people who violated the rules and seemed to recover, you know, longer after they should have been permanently vegetative. And those people, in retrospect, we think were misdiagnosed and minimally conscious. And we can talk later about why that misdiagnosis occurs.
Well, Dr. Kaplan, it still seems like we're trying to figure out the language then. Would that be fair to say?
It is. And, you know, it's not just the public who are sinners when it comes to being careful about the language. There are a lot of people who are in discussion with their physicians, and someone will say, I think your grandfather's vegetative, or I think your grandfather is in a permanent vegetative state, without necessarily having the exact diagnosis nailed down using current technology, or not paying attention closely to the etiology. What Dr. Finn said, I want to reinforce. You can be in situations where someone has gone without oxygen for a very long time. That was true years ago with Nancy Cruzan. It was true with Terry Schiavo. We know what kind of damage that does to the brain. It's irreversible and not something you're going to recover from if you go without getting oxygen to your brain for 30 minutes, let's say. That's very different than if you sustain a blow to the head, if you fall into a lake as a little child and are exposed to cold water for a long period of time. They're not all the same causes. The etiology or the sequence of events that leads to trouble in the brain is very different. I think we have better tools now to go back and take a look at the range of what might be going on in the brain. We have better understanding of the causes. but the precision of the language and how the conversation goes, it can get sloppy and therefore lead to some misunderstanding. You know, I get a lot of my medical information not from people like Dr. Finn's, but
– Well, you should.
I should, but instead I get it at the checkout counter at the supermarket where I'm looking at a tabloid magazine and –
And I don't publish there.
You know, he's not there, not a lot, anyway. And they don't quote him either. But the tabloid headline might say something like, policeman wakes up from vegetative coma after 20 years. Well, it's not clear what a vegetative coma means. People waking up from a coma, which is just a sort of prognosis type concept. You're unconscious, but you might recover.
But that was the case of Gary Daugherty.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and,
yeah,
and
yeah.
He probably
exactly.
was minimally conscious.
It exactly.
Was 1986, I believe.
Yeah.
It was one of the very
early
first
versions
cases
of
this but, person who, you know, and so it you know, the problem is that sometimes the alternative, non-credible media picks
yeah.
up these stories.
Oh,
when in fact there may be some credibility.
See,
there,
Joe isn't, he hasn't been visiting the supermarket. They're in there about once every couple of months. And that
right.
leads the public to start to say, well, if my grandmom's in a coma and policeman X woke up from this vegetative coma or other imprecise language like that, then we shouldn't be having an end-of-life discussion. We should be talking about how hard do we pray to facilitate the recovery, because I see it happening all around me. I see it in the tabloids. I see it in the popular media. A lot of people waking up.
Well, Dr. Kaplan and Dr. Finn, so with the lack of precision in this language, what kind of implication does that have medically and when people start thinking about talking about policy that might
right.
be developed on that?
Right. So first of all, the language is evolving. And, you know, one of my old teachers once said to me, in talking about this, is in the old days, in infectious disease, all we had were the fevers, and we had different kinds of fevers. These are descriptive categories. They're not mechanistic. They don't necessarily describe the mechanism of the injury. So these people who look the same overtly at the bedside might have very different things going on. And so one of the first things we have to do is overcome the discordance between what we see and what's going on. It's kind of like, you know, looking at plants that look identical and not knowing that their genetics might be different, so the genotype versus the phenotype. But we're at the stage before we've discovered DNA. We don't have a genetic transmission idea. We don't have the theory of genetic inheritance as it relates to brain injury. We're learning about mechanisms. So we've got a lot of people who appear the same who are fundamentally different. And even in what Dr. Kaplan just said, you know, cardiac arrest, it's true, 30 minutes. But it's not true if you got hypothermia, mm-hmm. if you got cold, if you got
it's that little child falls in the cold
right.
blade.
But now we're mm-hmm. doing that for cardiac arrest with chilled mm-hmm. saline.
Yep.
And it's totally changed all the data. We don't know, because that's an evolving story.
So Joe means here we have the ability starting to appear to quickly intervene after a heart attack and put people on ice. We're doing that at Penn, in fact, frequently, and we might flush them with a slurry type solution that's cold, or put their entire body into a cold environment. But sometimes people
ambulance.
Can recover.
You know, just you have, you know, saline on ice
yeah.
in the fridge
yeah.
in the ambulance, and it's going to dramatically change recovery rates of consciousness for people who otherwise would have had a devastating injury. The other point I want to just clarify, so we don't engender more confusion here in our dialogue, is up to this point, you know, it is our generic recommendation that the diagnosis of these people remain a clinical exam based on using what's called the coma recovery scale. Neuroimaging does not yet have a vetted
mm-hmm.
role.
Mm-hmm.
It may be used in an investigational setting for the exceptional case. But one of the major, you know, points is that one exam in a moment in time does not the diagnosis make of the minimally conscious state, because the biology of MCS is such that these people have episodic, intermittent manifestations of awareness or tracking.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody walks into the room. They don't do it all the time. So if I see a patient doing it and it is a loved one of mine, and I ask Dr. Kaplan to come in to verify it, the biology suggests that it won't be verifiable, because it's kind of like a flickering light. Sometimes it's on, sometimes it's off. But the key point is sometimes it's on.
Well, Dr. Kaplan, do things get complicated? And we're talking about complications here a lot. Back in February, a New England Journal of Medicine study, I think it was, about the fMRI and how that was showing some brain activity in an individual that was at least thought, I guess, to be in a permanent vegetative state. Mm-hmm. And so that created a ripple of discussion and debate. What mm-hmm. did you think about that study?
Well, I read the study, and I was not surprised to find out that there might be brain activity. The issue has always been, is it integrated? You can find brain activity in corpses. I mean, people who are absolutely, certainly quite dead. You can find probably some electrical cells firing. I did this with chickens. I haven't had the principle applied in humans, but you can see a chicken brain throwing and off what some electricity is it in, after it's been decapitated.
So. In the Wizard of Oz, about the Wicked Witch of the East, I think she is
truly,
absolutely,
solely, absolutely
truly dead.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, as people listen, they may be saying, okay, so there's flux in how we understand or what we're learning about. The ways in which people can have impairment of their brain, their cognitive function, their consciousness. In one sense, this isn't a bad thing. It's just a reality.